This is my project. I'm focusing on the Tomial tooth and a couple different groups of birds inside of the Neoaphes. So bill morphology varies really dramatically across all birds and reflects all the different sort of habits and habitats, foraging behaviors that they use, and it's been predicted that bill, like, diversity actually has a lot to do with how specious birds are, how many niches they occupy.
You missed two sentences.
A lot of bill diversity comes down to the trade-off between leverage and reach. So in something like a finch, where you want to have a lot of leverage in order to crack nuts or something like that, versus a hummingbird that doesn't need that leverage but needs a lot of reach to be able to interact with like floral bodies inside of flowers. I'm focusing in particular here on raptorial bills. All that really means is raptorial refers to this hook shape on the end of the bill, and it's found primarily in carnivorous birds that need that hook in order to perform some sort of ricking action. So tearing of flesh in order to break prey down into more manageable bites. Within the raptorial bill sort of archetype, there is some variation. And that variation mostly comes down to whether the bottom of the upper rampatheca, this keratinized structure that comprises what we see of the bill, is more flat, or if it has this curvature to it, which you see here, and the tip of that curvature is what's called the tomial tooth. It's probably best known in falcons, where its presumed usage is it is used to sever the cervical vertebrae of prey. So it's used as a means of dispatch. Whereas in things like eagles, they just use big claws and just basically stab prey to death. So if I'm looking at these bills, as near as I can see it, there are only three real landmarks inside of these bills. There's the top of the rampatheca where it interfaces with the soft tissue. There's the bottom where it does the same. And there's the tip. Everything else on the bill, as near as I can think of it, is a semi-landmark. You could think of this tomial tooth, I sort of wanted for a while to think about it as like a true landmark, but the more I've messed around with the data, the more I see that it can move forward and back on the bill pretty dramatically, and I don't think it constitutes a real landmark. So if that's the case, then what I'm really dealing with is two curves between A and B and between B and C. And most of what I've been doing so far is just trying to get curves to work inside of geomorph. So one of the questions I've been asking myself is, can I get away with using a single curve? So can I simplify my problem even further and eliminate the top of the bill? Like, is it informative for anything I'm doing? For the purposes of this study, I'm probably going to scale everything to like a single like point-to-point scale. And while I don't think that reflects a biological reality, either in terms of biomechanics or foraging behavior, it's the wrong model, but it's probably a useful model in this case. So thinking about simplifying this down so it's a single curve rather than full like that. As far as the phylogenetic context and why this is an interesting question from a phylogenetic perspective, this is a whole genome study that came out last year having to do with sort of reordering the entirety of birds. And some of the things that we already knew, but which were reinforced by this, is that eagles and vultures are separated pretty dramatically from falcons up here. And in each of these, and then Seriam is our sister to the group that contains falcons. The red here are toenail teeth type bills, and the blue are just flat curve reptorial bills. So you can see here, like, this idea of raptors. So some of the accipiters have toenail teeth, and then nearly all of the falcons have toenail teeth. It's also true that this is sort of a simplified overview, but passerines, which contain the majority of avian diversity, there's actually a clade inside of there where toenail teeth are present. And I think that's the Laniidae. So these are shrikes. And you can see here, the bill looks a lot different. It's closer to what you would think of as like a crow bill, where it's more elongated than we saw it in any of the other raptors, but it still has the same compound curve inside of it. So identifying, like, you can see all the same landmarks. Yeah.
These are the ones that, like, brown lizards and, like, piercing stuff in, like, fences and stuff.
Yeah, so these shrikes are known for this this prominent ecology where they basically grab birds and then impale them on thorn bushes and maintain a larder with them. They're one of the few birds that associate really strongly with barbed wire fences. And in the American Southwest, you can be walking along and you'll see stretches of barbed wire fence where there are like horned lizard skulls, basically stacked Mad Max style along like a stretch of fence. They're also incredibly vicious. So these are really tiny birds. Like the Laniidae are on average maybe 4 or 5 inches long. But they will attack lizards that are the same size of them. They will fight off much larger birds in defense of their larders. So this is actually the bird that got me interested in this whole question, because I saw the tooth when I was looking at one up at the Burke Museum. I was like, why does it have that? And it makes a lot of sense if it has that same vertebrate-killing biology that the falcons do. So this is my current conception for this project. So I'd like to just break this down to comparing two of the clades, the Laniidae and the Falconidae. So I'm going to ignore for a moment all of those intermediates and just look at two clades that have toenail teeth. And how similar are the toenail teeth features in each of those clades? So I think I'm going to have to look at them separately. I'm going to have to do like the crusties and everything for each of the clades separately, and then compare those analyses to each other to make this work. I wouldn't want to combine all of my falcons and all of my shrikes in one data set and run the same analysis on them, because I don't know if they'll be informative. Sample extensively across both clades as many species as I can get, using adult females in every case. Females are just larger, and the beaks will be bigger and easier to measure. Process single curves, and then in my final analysis, I have this question about whether I want to allow a precrusties of this, which I think will shift the landmarks away from each other, right? Like, does precrusties take into account semi-landmarks on a curve? Will it shift that?
You can certainly tell it to do so.
Yeah.
So it will still not do what you want it to do.
Right.
What does that mean, that precrusties on semi-landmarks, it will treat them as landmarks?
It will treat them as landmarks.
So your arbitrary placings will then interfere with the signal.
Right. With curves, one of the things that you can do, and this actually gets to what I've spent the last 5 hours of my life doing, is trying to get a function in Geomorph that takes your landmarks that you've assigned, makes a curve out of them, and then assigns equidistant points, like, basically, of the curve. Right? So that was my idea for how you sort of fix this problem of, well, I've assigned these landmarks, and, you know, there's no controlling for where they are. So if I have a set number of points along the curve, then at least I have some control of what's going on there. But then, so the question is, do you fix these two endpoints, these two landmarks, or do you allow all of these curves to sort of try to fit best with each other so that their endpoints are not the same?
There's a standard method that fixes them, and that just uses the sums of squares mm-hmm. of the distances between your corresponding points. It's usually called eigenshapes. It's been around for about 25 years, and it's a very good first pass. The problem with what I was suggesting to you a couple of weeks ago is the way you've drawn this proportional divisions of that horizontal chord won't work. You've got what the geometers love to call a rhomboid cusp there, but that doesn't matter. But if you block it by arc length, there are some papers by Jim Rolfe about that. It can be analyzed badly by elliptic Fourier analysis, but it can be analyzed quite well by the least squares methods. And it's, you could think of it as Procrustes with two landmarks, because right. with Procrustes with two landmarks, they're both fixed. So that if you can get geomorph to do that, which I'm surprised it's hard, that's a good standard late 20th century technique, which will give you a good start. And because it's a sum of squares, from this course you take the principal coordinates methods and do a principal coordinates analysis of the sum square distances between specimens.
Right. And then I should see some...
Look at factors.
Yeah.
So you could get either the toneal tooth moving or the toneal tooth getting sharper.
Deep.
Both of those could appear from this analysis, because both of those are patterns of changes of distance. So the answer to your question in red is yes, fix the two landmarks.
And then what do people think about only using one curve as opposed to two? Like, it certainly simplifies data acquisition, which is one of the things that I'm struggling with.
So the other curve would be the curve along the top.
Correct.
Well, you'll lose the information about how that curve might change and how the tooth might get deeper or shallower. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of how important is that information to you. I mean, I don't think I'm telling you anything you don't know, but you know.
Yeah, so when I think about it, the fact is that I don't know how important it is to me until I try both of them.
If there were to be a pattern that said the toneal tooth went along with a certain kind of change of depth, mm-hmm. my guess is you would want to know that.
That's a really interesting point, because one
or that a particular kind of shift in the toneal tooth went along with the depth.
Can I try to answer this in terms of the course materials? That your question about the top tooth, the top curve, can be resolved by taking a couple of a priori measurements, like the angle at the tip of the beak and then the height profile along the difference or something, and throwing that together with the description of this bottom curve into a partial least squares analysis. If there are correlations, like Joe was talking about, they'll come out. But since the top curve doesn't appear to have features, localized features, there's no reason to treat it morphometrically. It's just additional information that might correlate with the shape of the bottom. No, I interrupted what you were going to say.
No, so what I was immediately thinking was that falcons have generally shorter beaks, and I don't know why this has never occurred to me before, but the toneal tooth usually matches up with where the curve starts on the beak. And the same is true of shrikes, actually, that the toneal tooth usually matches up with where the curve is, but the curve, like this strong down curve, doesn't really occur until further down this long, like,
sounds like a
beak.
Really big embryological hit about a couple of compartments.
Well,
here.
But it could also be biomechanical, right? Because the toneal tooth should interact with the lower bill because they need to interface in order to.
I'm talking about morphogenesis. That if those two things seem to be synchronized on the bill, it's possible that they're being put down by the same system. Something is growing, something is extruded and then decides to make a turn. That's asking too much of the embryology of the bill, I've said. But it's certainly a hypothesis. If that's true, it'll turn up from an analysis where you do curvature of the top curve, which is easy enough to measure, although I don't know if JMorph gives it to you, but it's the second derivative of the curve. Curvature against whatever you're getting from the bottom. The curvature is a number, the bottom is a point, and again, this is a cross-correlation with the DLS projection of spurs.
Comments about phylogenetic issues
with
this?
Other people can make comments too. I think the phylogenetic part of it, I guess you're going to look at variation within each of these groups, and that's why
initially
you will need some phylogenetic information about that.
Yeah, initially my hope was that I was going to sample broadly across a bunch of different birds, like so sort of all of these intervening groups. That is a task that I'm not up to. And that no one has done yet, and which I honestly have no intention of seeking time to this.
But you're going to do some sampling in the Falcons and some sampling in the Accipitriformes.
Yes.
And whatever else. So you will need some phylogeny information for the birds that you sample.
Yes.
Within
so
each group.
There
yeah.
are reasonably good, like, samples for each of those, or phylogenies for each of those families.
Yeah.
So Laniidae, we have a pretty good idea. Falconiidae, pretty good idea. It's a little rough because there's a lot of like hybridization in those groups. But so I don't know how I'm doing on time, or if you guys have.
You're more
questions.
Or less out of it, but
all right.
Is anything else?
There's nothing else from me.
Okay.
Good. Very good.
Do we have number two? Are you using the projector?
Oh, I don't have the adapter.
Oh, do you not have an HDMI?
No.
Wait, you need to go to what? To this?
Office.
I have one. I have
oh,
one right
thank
here.
Thank you.
Yeah. Cool, Connor, that will work. That will work at least as well as anything that was done 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The way they analyze the shape
this
of the eggs,
here
and
oh, yeah.
learn things.
Oh, yeah.
It's the way
yep.
it goes
like
the shape of
like pottery.
Yeah, it's the way you analyze the shape of essentially convex curves that might.
If I can find where it goes.
Is that the HDMI?
Yeah.
Oh, it has to go in there. Yeah, that's right.
Got it.
Yeah, we're in business.
Right. So the project for this class is a part of my dissertation project. So I'm going to give a overview for all the project. If you have any input on this, I would really appreciate it. And then I will give the subsection that I'm intended to do for this quarter. So I'm going to do, my project is entitled Evolution of Swimming Tree Frogs. So it's a comparative study that integrates phylogeny, microhabitat use, locomotion, divided in performance and behavior, and morphology, like character, morphological characters. So my question the other day in the class is because I have all these data from different individuals, different populations, different species, and different genera. And then for all of them, I record morphological traits as linear measurements and areas. And then for performance, I have behavior and speed, and then for microhabitat, I divide it by aquatic and arboreal. So for the morphology, I took 9 linear measurements, which are basically limb lengths and snow bend length, and then for area, I took compact area because they are arboreal frogs, and then the whole area of the hand and the foot, which might be helping when they row, when they kick, while they're swimming. For microhabitat, I divided by canopy, understory, and forest floor. And there are some really specific frogs that only live in tree holes that they don't live in the other types, which I think is worth considering because they are not doing a lot of movement. And then for aquatic habitat, I divided by pond, like still ponds, lentic and lotic. And finally, for performance, I have data for speed of a complete swimming trial, one sequence of one stroke, and each movement within each stroke. And then for behavior, I divided by arm position, if they keep the arms forward or backward, if they alternate or kick simultaneously with the back legs, and if they have a complete half of offset rowing with the hands. So if we put this in a phylogenetic context, this is the phylogeny for the genera, and then the phylogeny with all the species is way more complicated than this one. But then we see that the distribution of the traits, the microhabitat use is variable. And then the one on the right is the phylogeny with the speed. So that the speed is also different among genera. And then my question is, how can I make inferences between morphology, performance, and microhabitat? So I have two main objectives. The first one is compare how phylogenetic history and microhabitat use are influencing the evolution of the morphological traits. And the next one is how swimming microhabitat and morphology are all related in the evolution of this group of frogs. So then for the class project, I'm only going to use the morphological traits, and I'm going to do it by genera. And finally, for the methods that I'm proposing to use for this class, first, it's a PCA of the long transport morphological data across species. Then I will try to determine the optimal model of character evolution. So we talk a little bit about Brownian motion and OU, but then I found a paper that said that it's also worth it to try the arithmetic Brownian motion. So I would like to see which model fits better. And then
what's the A? The
arithmetic
A?
Brownian motion. They said that it's the same.
What is that? How's that?
A trend?
I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, okay.
Never heard of it.
Okay. And then a Bayesian stochastic character mapping. I'm not sure if phylogenetic PCA is the best one or there's another method that I could use. And generalized least squares and phylogenetic linear model. So for all this, I think I still need to polish a little bit the methods. I think that's all I have.
I think that phylogenetic PCA, if you do contrasts and you then do a PCA on the contrast, I believe it's equivalent to phylogenetic PCA. But I guess the other question I'd ask is, for this course, you're doing morphology, but not using specifically morphometric methods. You're measuring areas and lengths.
The log length, log area are specifically morphometric methods.
Okay, well, if they have your approval as being morphometric, then it's okay.
It's chapter 2 and chapter 3 of the book that only has 5 chapters. Yeah, that's certainly specifically morphometric.
Could you go back to the measurements on the feet? You had a little figure about them. I guess the question is whether, when you collect the area, how do you do it?
So I have the pictures, and I do imaging just to measure the surface area of the hand.
You do what?
So in this program, ImageJ.
It's from NIH.
Which is just, it'll like digitize around the outline?
Yes.
And then, so the only question would be, if one wanted to go deeper into morphometrics on that, would you be able to capture the digitized curves?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I guess would be more like semi-landmark data than landmark data.
Well, actually, it's a branching structure here that's drawn. So it isn't either one.
Okay, but if you had morphometric coordinates going around the outside, which are collected by the machine.
It's a curve, but it's not semi-landmark. You're not sliding according to any criteria based on the form.
Well, presumably there's some scheme for how often it ticks when it's collecting.
Right, but after that, to my knowledge, ImageJ doesn't slide them. They're not homologous.
Yeah, right. They're not homologous, so they're not landmarks.
They're not even semi-landmarks. They're just points on the outline. And that's the analysis.
Yeah, I guess the only question would be, would detecting other kinds of shape change than just change of area be of interest to you?
So I was thinking a little bit the shape of the head, because that will reduce the drag. So then that will be easier because we have a lot of points along it, like the position of the eyes, of the tympanum, or the tip of the snout. So that could be one. But then with the hands, they have so much variation within the area of the toe pad and the area of the web, the length of the fingers. So I don't know if I can get a lot of information just by the overall area. Like if I do it with a lamp.
You say you. Yeah.
But if the toe pad is more convoluted, so the toes project more and there's less webbing interface, then the surface area to circumference ratio will go down. And I think that's something that you could calculate fairly easily from that ImageJ output. Because it can tell you, like, how convoluted your toe pad is, or how many inclusions it has, and that might give you an idea of per unit area how effective is that area. I don't know.
I would make a related suggestion, which is that if swimming is one of the concerns of the thesis, then the energetic cost of swimming is mostly turbulence, and turbulence is a function of the large-scale shape of the hand and the foot, because they're, I don't know how much the legs press against the water, but certainly when I swim, the hands and the feet press against the water. Mm-hmm. And there are formulas for turbulence of branching structures. These would be specific formulas. They're probably, they have things like cubes in them and the angles between the fingers. But if you look at I haven't done this, but if you look at Olympic swimmers, either their hands are like this or their hands are like this. And I don't know which, but it has to be one of those two. Either they're using fins or they're using trees. Figure out which, and then measure the angular extension, which is very close to what Connor's suggesting is the circularity of that thing. But that should relate to mechanical performance. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if they're amphibious, then the foot and the hand also have to work on land, not just on the ocean, not just
on the
water.
And they are arboreal trees, so they also work.
Okay, so you've got competing functional needs for these structures, and each habitat, microhabitat, will have a different formula for biomechanical efficiency. Find those formulas, and they will give you the derived variables you want to get from the MHJ. When your very first slide where it said log transform measurements, that solves the problem of area versus length. So that's exactly right. Joe was right. The shape of the extremities mm-hmm. is relevant, but not as a morphometric block of variables. It's relevant as a biomechanical block of variables.
Well, because of the nature of the course, we're focusing on things like this, but you have many other pressures in your thesis, I can see.
Yeah.
One of the levels you have is populations, and you raised that very difficult point when we had the discussion. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to either next time or the last time talk about the problems involved in that, in just dealing with differentiation among populations of a single species. It's difficult.
Yeah. Because I also have the question that my sampling right now is the orange branches. So then if I cannot find the rest of the species, I mean, I can do morphology for all of them, but if I cannot find the rest of the species to do the performance trials, and the other thing, like how do you correct for this when you frame it in the phylogenetic context, but you don't have all the to do the analysis.
You're talking about the problem of the missing data if you're not able to collect the swimming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's most of the. Fred was indicating earlier that there's a lot of controversy over how to deal with missing data, and one, you can just throw away a lot of. You know, just confine yourself to the ones you have full data on.
Well, also, these are all the extants. General, right?
Yeah.
And there are 1,000 more that are extinct that you don't have.
Yeah.
So generalization across the, whether this is an order or family at a lower level.
It's a family.
It's family. Generalization across the family is likely to be impossible. But finding the underlying principles of correlation between the three things you're studying, that could be really informative and useful. So I don't think the idea of missing some of the existing genera is as important as getting down to the underlying, I keep on saying biomechanics, but that's, there's also hydrodynamics, and however a frog has baby frogs, and all the rest of this. And then you mentioned the tree climbing, about which I know nothing, not being an arboreal creature myself. I only know how to swim. But so you got half of the existing genera, I'm just very quickly counting. That seems pretty good. The only thing that bothers me a little is that Plectrohyla there is acting like an outgroup, and it would be important to know that in some sense it's typical of that little cluster of three. Is that similar enough to Sarcohyla and Pseudodonta to be a good outgroup sort of choice? Because when you do your PCA, that's going to anchor one end of PC1 probably. So the alternative is to try it with and without Plectrohyla to see how much difference that makes. Just do it twice and look to see if much changes. I gave you that example where we threw the Neanderthals out from the human data and it totally changed the analysis. It's the same kind of thing. Don't use Plectrohyla, see if it matters. And if it does matter, do it both ways and say so.
In the naive analysis, which is what I usually talk about, one takes whatever species you have and you're inferring covariation among characters in a model of sort of correlated covarying Brownian motion. That assumes that the model is the same throughout the tree. If it is, and if it's close to that, then missing taxa aren't necessarily going to hurt you badly. They're less data, but they're less data, but it's not a big problem in principle. But the problem Fred is raising is, suppose that the model starts to change as you move across the phylogeny. You would want to know about that, and the procedure he's suggesting, things like that, or throwing out, looking only within one of the clay. The bottom two thirds is one big clay, and throw out some of the others. Some sort of analysis like that to check whether there's a sign of the models being violated would be. As the Neanderthals.
Yeah, the word for that was invented by Richard Raymond about 20 years ago. It's called looking for influential observations. And my hunch is that Plectrohyla is influential, but it might fit the model. And that would be worth knowing either way.
I don't think the fact that you're missing some data on some of the species should be a big worry. I don't think you... Fred was raising the point, we don't have any of the fossil species, so we're already missing a lot. Even if you get all of these, you're still missing that. And if the model holds uniformly over the whole phylogeny, then you're okay, even though you're missing half the...
I'm smiling because that's exactly the content of the paper I just wrote for that anthropology conference. It doesn't matter how many fossil species there were, we have no behavior in it.
So
I worry about how many fossil species there are.
My final question is that for this objective, so the best approach to integrate the three data sets,
how do you do it?
Well,
it's called three block PLS.
What are the pros and the cons, and how much confidence is there a way to get a good approach to this question?
Yeah, it's called three-block PLS. It's covered in the book you've got, in an example from psychology. And to get confidence in it are the standard leave-one-out approaches, know, jackknifing and so on, you fit it, leaving out each genus in turn, and look to see essentially how much the answers vary and scale them up by 6/5 or whatever the appropriate factor is. But it's a standard enough technique that you don't have to invent it.
Well, also, leaving that aside for the moment, if each of these, if the variables you measure for swimming and morphology are, the ones for swimming and morphology are characters of the organism. The ones for microhabitat are environmental measures. For the swimming and morphology, if you can get variables that are roughly look to be normally distributed, that is, they're on a scale and they might be normally distributed, which may require some messing about with your variables, then you could just use look at covariation across a phylogeny using the methods that we, you know, using contrast methods or whatever methods to get covariances, correlations, fitting models. The habitat one is a little hard because you don't have an evolutionary model for how one habitat changes into another, because it's not a character of an organism. So that was this problem that I mentioned in some of my lectures. But generally, the approach would be for the characters of the organism, kind of put them all in. If you can massage them to make them look normal, then you can use these normal distribution approaches that we've been
small
talking about.
All they have to use is these squares. They don't have to be normal. They just have to have finite variance, which they do because they're normal.
Fred and I are passing each other by in these comments.
I wouldn't ever use a normal distribution here. I would just use these squares.
I would always use a normal distribution
here. Yeah, that's
anyway, I hope so.
That looks good.
Yeah, I think we have to move on to somebody else. Is there a number three? And we have two more presentations, three more presentations. Yeah, so we're roughly on time, but we're a little behind. So. Which connector do you need?
This HDMI. Yep.
I got this data set from some collaborators and friends back at University of California, Davis, and they had some sort of questions about how shape and locomotion interplay in the damsel fishes. Briefly, what the data set I have access to looks like. In total, there are 430 specimens, comprising 91 species, up to 15 specimens a species, but really that's a lot to have, like, 7 or 8, and a bunch that have 1 or 2. There are 21 landmarks in total. I've got a schematic of where they are. And then they've got these species classified by locomotion. So they classified them as either things that swim with their pectoral fins, or things that swim basically like with a whole body undulation.
So just two classes?
Yeah, A and B. Actually, it's going to be blue and orange and some of the stuff I have later. So the 21 landmarks on the fishes look like that. To me, it kind of looks like 12 of them outline the fish reasonably well. So I'm going to focus, or I was thinking of focusing in on 12 of them. What got them initially interested in this shape locomotion interplay was this geomorph figure that they made, where on this end, they colored it by the locomotion.
Yeah.
There's a lot of missing data on locomotion, which is a problem.
It
looks like those, I don't remember which the colors were here, but it looks like they have access to sort of a relatively taller and shorter region of morphospace. So I cleaned up the data set a little bit and I discarded some stuff. So I stuck to the 12 landmarks on the outside, all the full data, because there tended to be not too many samples for the species that were missing anyways. Left with 76 species. And then these landmarks, which I think do a reasonably good job of approximating the outline of the fish. And they're also, like, a lot of those are attached to the mouth ones, are attached to actually, like, functional morphology traits, so I didn't really want to do those.
I missed your corrected number of species, was that?
Oh, 76.
76.
76 species. With full data. and none of these fit landmarks or the morphological ones. And then I tried to redo the figure, and it actually looks more interesting to me now, because there's still this, in this case, we've got the pectoral fin swimmers are blue, and the full body swimmers are orange. But, and not only is there still that pattern, unphylogenetically, not only does it still look like there's that pattern of the pectoral fin swimmers can get into this much taller and shorter space, but there's also this divide here, which Geomorph says looks like it's sort of a elongation of the last space before the tail.
Of course, those covariant structures are completely different, and the pooled analysis has to be wrong. But there's analysis in your handout that's correct, which is the likelihood, the quadratic likelihood surface. So the PC assumptions here are completely in, are completely violated by the data here, because there's the covariance of the yellows, the covariance of the blues is different.
Yeah, that
so
was
you can't
one of the
separate
things
the species from you can't talk about how the species differ from a picture assuming they're the same.
Which is one of the things I wanted to get into, because like this was just sort of what started it, and I wanted to see if I still could see that, if it wasn't some artifact of like the fact that they were looking at all the individuals or that they had these other landmarks. This was sort of my launching point. I actually tried to look at a few things.
I was looking for the pictures. You keep going.
Because what I tried to do was I looked at the tree, and I saw that there were two relatively large, similarly aged clades in each swimming mode. So I was thinking one thing that could be done is just look at each of those individually, because then you don't have to account for the changes on the tree of the states that are making a difference. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure how to properly ask the question in a phylogenetic context of shape and swimming mode evolving in tandem. Because to one extent, what I think you kind of want to do is like a stochastic mapping and then try two rate models on the tree. But I do not know of any infrastructure for handling multiple traits that are covarying in their evolution like those landmarks would. I don't know if that works because you were saying the other day you can't actually like test for optimum selection when you have high-dimensional data.
That's a different point from how to handle the morphometrics. Joe has been writing for many more years than I have about that point. But I think in terms of that scatter plot, you'd want to start by applying a standard kind of phylogenetic contrast methods to the quadratic discriminant problem. You're setting up an effect. Your question can start by saying, what is it about the form that best differentiates those two classes of swimmers? Mm-hmm. The question about the definition of the word best is modified by a phylogenetic correction, but the morphometric context is the picture that I showed you several weeks ago, in which two groups have different covariant structures, and that starts as a quadratic discriminant, which completely violates the assumptions of the PCA, but it answers the question you're asking, which is how do you best differentiate those groups? So you would notice, for instance, that there was a big cluster of pure yellows and a big cluster of pure blues and then some overlap, and you'd want to know what those features were. That PC isn't getting them, but there are those clusters, and the phylogenetic correction will work.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the two issues here that I can see. Three. This is a Monty Python routine. We keep adding them. One is this issue of that the scattering on those diagrams looks like it is the covariance structure is different in different groups.
It does kind of.
And that's the issue. You know, Fred is raising that. And the second is, suppose you could somehow solve that and get yourself onto some scales where you're willing then to use a normal model on the resulting variables.
That is a normal model, but they have different covariances.
No, whatever. The thing that I see here, I see two things. One is that I left my glasses in the bag here.
All right, because I want to use it. You could look at changes within this blue group and within that group, but of course one of the things you're asking is what is involved in changes between them.
Yeah.
Down in this region, there is a lot of additional information. For example, what's involved in going from that yellow one to that blue one, from this yellow blue one to that yellow one.
Some of those. Yeah.
So these are some pairwise
these
comparisons.
These are all the system comparisons that I could extract.
If you wanted to do a not just looking at pairs, which is legitimate, but looking at the whole thing, then you want to do some kind of phylogenetic comparative method, either contrasts or equivalent methods, on the variables which are. You basically would get some sort of GPA, well, a rough way, but some sort of a GPA superposition, then use the coordinates from that. And yes, they co-vary with each other, but that's what we've been talking about. And you want to know what kind of, what kind of variation there is there. The additional question of the two types of swimming where you have each species classified into one of those two types. One way would be to make that a discrete variable, and there's this threshold analysis, this threshold method that I've published, which
treats the discrete as if it's actually latent continuous.
Yeah, it's a continuous thing with a threshold, and then it becomes, in effect, another normal variable. And you can.
I think that would be a sensible way to take like the 12 landmarks and then.
You could see how they co-vary with the unknown underlying liability variable for that. That's a sort of naive way of approaching it that I was thinking of. Okay. Freddie will now tell you a completely different.
But also, is it appropriate to take these landmarks and then evolve them under a covarying?
I hope so, because that's what, Fred and I are writing a paper on that right now.
Well, yes and no, because since the covariance structures are different between the two groups, either it's a non-stationary non-in-motion process, or what you're co-evolving isn't just the landmarks, but it's also in some sense the squares and the landmarks. So you might have to be in a higher dimensional space.
Yeah, you might have to go.
Motion.
You might have to find out how to go to some other set of variables to solve the problem of the covariances being known simply different.
Yeah, but the first step would be the one that Joe explains, to combine the phylogenetic contrast method with the search for a discriminant function between the two groups. And I'm saying the discriminant function has to have the squares, the landmark coordinates, not just the landmark coordinates, but that's okay.
I think if you use this threshold thing, it will somehow be equivalent to some kind of a discriminant
threshold thing.
Analysis.
Is pretty equivalent to a discriminant function. If everything is normal, they are equivalent, so they're off to a good start.
We'll talk about it later.
I'm agreeing with you. Why would we talk about it later?
Where we're violently agreeing.
Yeah. No, but what we need is a really big page with all those pairs, and we can look to see if there are family resemblances among all of the pairs that have one, I forgot what your words are, one pectoral on the top and one
these are,
body on the bottom.
Yeah, all of the actual sister species pairs on the tree.
Yeah, these diagrams
are
intended to do that.
But this is all of them?
So there are no other sister tip pairs.
I was taking all pairs to see what the visualizations are like. But you could do it randomly. I think you call it sister species. I like cousin species myself. But again, this should work. Mm-hmm. And given that Davis found a pattern that's interpretable, it's a very good start. What we're trying to do is figure out, what Joe and I are trying to do, is figure out if there's some underlying description of what's going on that's simpler than all of the possible ways these groups can vary. Mm-hmm. It does look large scale, which matters. it's a, it looks like a linear transformation on the PC plot. It doesn't look like that over here in the lower right corner. That's a very localized transformation we've got there. I hope that's not typical. Is Zeiss run to see animals? Something funny is going on there, or the eye, or whatever, what is up
the top one, I think.
But this should work, and it does seem like a good choice of project to me. Why are they called damsels? That's chapter 3.
I wrote down in my notes damsel flies, and then I discovered these are fishes. But
they eat damsels.
There's something. There's something, and there's states and tricks.
Right.
So we have to do the next.
Yeah.
Everyone has a computer presentation. So. What connector do you need?
PCA.
You should be able to put it right there. And I assume it'll be fine. It's looking for HDMI. Probably press the source button, which is there.
Okay, so I got this data set from Charlie Santana, and it was published in this work in the Journal of Evolutionary Biology. And her question was essentially about whether nasal echolocation, is there third modularity involved in, like, that's reflected in skulls of these bats. I'm looking at a specific genera of rhinolophids, which are a genera of horseshoe bats. And if you can look at the face, you can tell that there's a weird-looking nose. And it's really, they think that the ancestral state was oral echolocation, but then this evolved from that because they can kind of chew and bite and still echolocate while they fly. So typically, the mammalian skull modularity is identified to be the brain case, the rostrum. And in this paper, they were trying to see if they can identify a third, if they can find like some proof for a third modularity for the nasal dome here, which is like an area where they use for the sound to reverberate from their nose.
You talked about this. You do know I object to what you just said as the typical modularity. I believe that is nonsense, and it's not your problem.
I'm going to hit that. So I have a question about that, and then I will talk about that. So these are I have two views. I have the lateral view and the ventral view. Lateral view and the ventral view. The lateral view, let me back up. I have 73 specimens that represent 22 species. I have a lateral view that has 14 landmarks that are represented by black, the black dots, and 9 semi-landmarks that are represented by the white dots. And for the ventral view, I have 13 landmarks.
When you say you have, meaning they've already been collected.
Yes.
The data. Yep.
Yes. So my idea is I'm really new to this. I'm just trying to see if I can do a reanalysis of this paper and also maybe find some new methods that we can apply. So some of the results here. So they did a phylogenetic permutation test for shape data, and my understanding is that they're just looking for a phylogenetic signal in the shape and size. They found a significant signal in skull shape for both ventral and the lateral skull shapes, but not for centroid size. And then they used a application of RV coefficients, and this is, I think, the problem, where when they found that it doesn't support the module hypothesis. Now, RV coefficient is basically what it does is it ranges from 0 to 1, where 0 is no covariation and 1 is perfect covariation. And the idea of modularity is that covariation should be stronger within modules and not between modules. And however, I was looking up, so there's Fred brought up there's issues with this, and I was looking up why there may be, and I found F.J. Rolfe's comments on this on a forum,
And he says that basically the problem with this is that it just ignores spatial scale and distribution of the landmarks. And I'm just quoting him directly, is that the if you cluster by distance, it's, you can expect it to kind of have similar results like the cluster by correlation. And I think that's the issue. And a lot of, there's a lot of, the forum was pretty, a lot of arguments about just what to use for this kind of analysis, because it's just
What was the name of the person who's commented this
morning? F.J. Rolf.
Hmm?
Rolf.
Rolf, yes. Jim Rolf.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and I'm not quite sure what, I'm a little bit confused what the RV coefficient is. Is that different from a three separate, like, so the, so this is the result of the RV, using the RV coefficients. And I, it looks like it's doing, like, three separate two-block partial least squares. Is that what it is?
Yeah. I don't want to take too much time. If, from the shape coordinates, if you list them all out for one block this way, and then list them this way for the other block, the RV coefficient is, in effect, an analysis of the squares of the correlations in that matrix divided by something like the sum of the squared principal components of each block separately. And in a paper of mine that I haven't handed out to you, I have explained that is total nonsense as a number. It doesn't correspond to anything biological, particularly if there is strong integration in either module. You'll get the wrong answer from RV. It works only if they are totally unintegrated, so that all the correlations in each block are the same, and that's not the case. But that's the basic idea. It actually comes from educational psychology of about 30 years ago, and Klingenberg just found it and threw it in because he could. I think it's because I didn't read that paper. Rolf then accepted my critique.
This seems to be like a pretty widespread. It's used pretty widespread, I feel like.
It is, and it is garbage. And Rolf is horrified that the use is widespread and it is garbage.
I don't know anything about RV. I get the general impression that the whole area of modularity is
fraught.
Well, it's in the midst of turmoil. But the other issue is just as a personal observation, I'll say, not knowing the details here, that when you have a disagreement between Klingenberg and Rolf, go with Rolf. You know.
Right.
So I think Fred and I are agreed on that.
And you mentioned earlier about a pre-block PLS.
Yeah.
Is that the method that?
No, RV doesn't apply to three-block PLS. It is a number for a pair of blocks. I guess it could be extended to three blocks, but since it's such a bad idea anyway, there's no point in doing it.
So this is where I didn't
talk about it.
This is where I was thinking, is there another method here that you...
There's a Kubo's method, but we don't know what it is yet.
Kubo's?
Oh, Kubo's method, which we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't yet know what it is, but it will be better than what we have.
Okay, well, what's done in the book that was handed out to you in somewhere in chapter 5.8 is an example of testing, I think, in that case, I just used two modules, PLS, two regions PLS against a pooled one principal component, and just sort of looked at the difference. That extends to three blocks, but not there, it has no single summary like the RV for the strength. It is, in effect, a comparison of a single-factor model against a three-factor model in that case. And you'd expect it to get better, but there's no general statistic for it. It would be specific for the spacing of the landmarks. But you can certainly ask the question you want correctly by saying, does the residual from first principal component concentrate in block three? That would be the way you'd ask it. Are the strongest leftover correlations within block three rather than within block one or within block two? It's not a statistical question, it's a biological one. And yeah, that would work. And if you got chapter five, there's that example somewhere near the end of two-block PLS versus relative warp one. And this is the same thing as we have. In effect, a three-block PLS versus relative warp one. So you could do that.
Yeah, for these bats, do you have a phylogeny?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, you could do all of those analyses with phylogenetic correction if you want. In fact, that's probably a pretty good idea.
Joe, would it also be reasonable to, in a phylogenetic context, to test that with like a multivariate covariate Brownian motion model and look for blocks that covariate a priori, or not a priori, posteriori?
Yeah.
Just see if those landmarks tend
yes.
to together?
I think, yeah. You can either take predefined blocks or you can take blocks that you discovered.
Yeah, so yeah, so this method is, I think, predefined versus just like the modules.
Yeah, and I think once you discover, you'd have to have a method. You want to have a method that not just said this bunch of coordinates are all correlated, but also looked at where they were spatially, which I'm not sure quite what the methods would be to add a constraint like that.
Well, that's what the integration statistic does. It takes their spacing into account. So instead of the partial warps here, you'd have the residual partial warps from RW1. And then you could look to see if the pattern of integration is concentrated in area 3, given that you know those points are close together. It can be done. I don't have an example. Actually, this is a lovely example of a technique I haven't had data to try it on yet.
In general, it seems like you have a ton of good data here. Mm-hmm. And basically play with methods and find out more about them and see what you can come up with. Yeah. It's different from what these people
actually
are suggesting.
The example you want then is what Chapter 5 did for the RAP data. It threw all of these techniques on the same data set to see how many kinds of different answers you get. So try principal components, try partial least squares, try discriminant function analysis, everything phylogenetically corrected, and see if you always get the same answer or get different answers.
This will take you
a week.
Yeah, well, I think the whole project will take you about 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Is this a dissertation, I hope? No? It's a paper.
Anyway, you can do something.
Yeah. It's a paper with Santana. We may have tenure by the time you get there. No, Joe's right. This is a good data set. That the RV statistics are bad, but we have good statistics to throw in that take the landmark spacing into account. And when Rolf posted that note on the forum, he was quoting me verbatim.
Yeah,
so
I
don't disagree with that at all.
He's quoting.
He was a reviewer of the paper that I was referring to, and an early adopter. And he's the origin of the mosquito data that you've got in the book, which shows the integration for biomechanical reasons. This could be a perfect analog of that, showing an integrated subregion for sensorial reasons. If 3 is a module, it must be because of what it's doing. Our nose isn't an embryological unit. That's not an embryological unit. It's not a piece of mesoderm. It would have to be functional.
So I think we're right on. Are you at the end of your projection?
Yeah,
there's
a couple of stuff. So this is a phylogeny. They also did
that's a little unbalanced there. You have two outgroups, and I'm not sure about the branching there at the left of the picture. Are you? Do we really know that's not a three-way? Really?
Well, you know, actually, in
separated by 50 years
in phylogenetic comparative methods of any kind, if you have branchings that occur that rapidly, mm-hmm. The exact order isn't going to actually matter very much.
But it's drawn. That's what.
Well, it's drawn and may or may not be correct, but it actually doesn't matter if this split here. You know, and this tiny little branch here really is, you know, if things are rearranged there, it won't make much difference.
The contrast method will make all of those uncertainties go away.
Yeah.
And it also labeled the color or the geographic location, the distributions of these, and they did a shape analysis, BCE on this, to see if a certain shape correlated with it.
So this was done on the digitized data.
Yes.
This is something you did or they did?
They did. This is, I haven't, yeah.
You haven't
done
it yet.
Okay. Yeah, this is what Peter did.
And
So they got some PCAs out using a comparative approach, I hope. Well, however they did it. Some papers that are out there get their PCAs from the they do the GPA and then they get their PCAs at that stage without yet looking at the phylogeny, which is not a great idea.
Then throw the phylogeny on it.
Then they throw the phylogeny in. You want to have the ideally you'd like to have the whole PCA, the whole GPA, the Procrustes superposition. Reconsidered in light of the phylogeny. Basically, nobody is doing that.
It's in the book. How can you say nobody is doing it? I did it.
Okay.
With your help.
Okay.
It's in the handout.
Yeah, in that example, yes. It's been done, yes. Even if you do an ordinary generalized Procrustes, after that, before you get principal components, you want to start doing things with phylogenetic comparative methods.
Right. So the evidence, I guess, driving this analysis is that PC3 seems to have a nose on it, PC1 seems to have a nose on it. That phenomenon is going to screw up the RB coefficient immediately. You see, you can't, from this PCA, you will get, it's clear you're going to get the wrong answer from the RB coefficient. Because it's the finding is on two of the PCs separately, but not the third one. And, of course, it's not in the ventral view. Somebody noticed, I hope, that the first two PCs in the ventral view are the same. Those don't exist as separate consequences. Their eigenvalues are the same. That's a circle. The first two. And then the chart you use is in the book. So it doesn't meet the threshold for being different. But, so the issue of whether PC3 is a module can go either way, depending on your new analysis. What they published is probably the wrong answer.
This is some supplementary figures looking at the ventral view. So they found that PC1 and PC3 were related with the geographic distribution. Mm-hmm. And so the African and Mediterranean group. Yes, the African and Mediterranean group were significantly different from the Southeast Asian group here.
But let's stop there, because there's another beautiful example here that the axis for differentiation of the regions isn't a PC, it's this one. These regions are perfectly separated in this direction. 1, 2, and then 3 and 4 overlap, and we see that all the time, but this isn't a PC. Separation, the classification, isn't what PCs are asking about.
I suspect
they're not answering them.
I suspect that none of that was done with the phylogeny.
Oh, this is...
Okay.
Yeah, they did do a phylogeny independent contrast.
To get this?
But still, the question of if those regions happen to have different behaviors, I don't know, the axis of behavior would be oblique to the PCs, and that will seriously screw up the RB analysis.
That aside, I think I see from this figure that it is not phylogenetic, but we'll talk about it later. Anyway.
And then this is the same thing with from the lateral.
That's the one that's circular.
Okay. So we have one more.
Right.
And we're not quite on time, but almost.
So that is just it's a perfect choice of data set for this course because it's a reanalysis. Okay. Somebody else did all the heavy lifting.
No, there's a lot of heavy analysis at it. There's a lot of heavy analysis at it. No, not that one. One of these has it. Yeah. Computers to projectors than it was 10 years ago when you had to shut everything down and turn it back on.
And try to remember if it was the F14 key or the F8 key.
Yeah, let's see. Beautiful.
Okay. Well,
It started doing it.
The thread crashed.
Then it,
hide the details. This report will be sent to Apple. It's a tablet thing.
It's because it's not a software. So my background is really different from most of the others. So I'm from genetic background. So I'm gonna so for my podcast, they are gonna be a little bit different from others. I'm going to use some morphometrical approach to study the comparative genes, and actually one of my long-term interest to bridge the gap between the physical changes and the phenotype changes, just include the morphological changes. So this is my other manner of firstly, I'm going to talk about some background. I will talk about the two theories. We have a relation theory and the power class model. This is the theories inspired me to have this problem. And then I have two ends. Hopefully I can finish for this class. So one end is I wanted I'm going to use one data set just published last week on Science, in Science. they use the embryonic, they study the human embryonic development process. And they also have some data set for the chicken and the maize. So I'm going to do some cross-species comparative analysis too. So the second thing is, as I said, I wanted to bridge the transcription changes and the movement change. So I'm also going to use another data set recently published this year. They sequenced more than 10 different species. So 10 different species during the embryogenesis process. And I'm going to use this data set and train to apply some morphometrical approach to analyze the data. So I think probably most of the people here know this figure. So this is a figure to describe the recombination theory. Basically, in this figure, each column corresponds to a different species, and each row corresponds to some equivalent development stage for different species.
I think it's the other way around. Say that again.
If each column is a species. And each row is
I see,
stage.
You're right. Yeah,
yeah,
I was wrong. Sorry.
Yeah. And you can see, very obviously, there's a really early stage of the development process. Almost all the species look really similar, but they gradually diverge. A lot of people interpret the recombination theory as the embryogenesis for different species goes from firstly through a really ancient species and then more recent species and then most recent ancestors. Actually, this is a lot not intended for from the person who proposed the recombination theory. So the person is Anderson Haeckel. In what he said, it just means during the development process, most of the species share very similar shape at the beginning of the development process, and then gradually diverged. And this idea was later developed, and people developed a new, a similar model to explain the abrogenesis of different species. This is called the power class model. So in this model, they say at the beginning stage of ontogeny of abrogenesis, species from all vertebrates, they are really different, but there is an important stage called the phenotypic stage. At that stage, most of the species they share really similar form. And then after that stage, the form for different embryo, different species, so that they can work in. But all this work is just found in the morphometrics. A few years ago, there are two papers published in Nature. They trying to use the RNA-seq, which is a method to measure the transcriptome count for the cells. And the first paper they find for the sequence they flew vertebrates, and they find the all the vertebrates share similar transcriptome pattern at a particular stage, and this pattern, gene expression dynamics follow some kind of hourglass model. And another paper published over the same time, they also find even in the plant, they also have a similar transcriptome hourglass model. On the other hand, just published last week, there is a new study. They collected more than I think 150,000 strands, and they recreated the interactive three dimensional human embryogenesis database. And here I'm going to talk a little bit some of the results. So this is one result I think is really interesting. In the panel B here, it describes the embryo warning during the embryo warning during the embryogenesis process. You can see the blue band is this man here. Described is on the original scale. You can see the volume of embryo exponentially increased during the abrogenesis process. And when they look at the different organs, look at the liver, neural tube, and the metal nerve followers and the notch cord, and you can see different organs have different patterns. For example, the relative embryo volume for the neural tube, they remain constant during the embryogenesis, while the node cord, they gradually decreased. And for the liver, the candidate could possibly have an exponential increase and then go to some equilibrium stage. So they also found that, because as I mentioned at the beginning, they also included some data for the mice and the chicken. So here is an example of the analysis they studied the year development for these three different species. And they found although all the three different species they share the same order of the development process, but the timing that are changed between different species they have some really obvious phenotypes for the year development process three species. So I think my question is my first question is I wanted to, because we already have this data set, wanted to ask is whether or not when we compare the for example, when we compare the position of all the organs for chicken, mice, and human, whether or not we can find a stage where all the position of all the species are missing each other. And that stage potentially going to, if it's true, I wanted to say whether or not that stage corresponding to the phenotypical stage. And then I also wanted to see whether or not before that stage and after that stage, the position of the other organs, because of three species, whether or not they are very different. So this will help us to answer whether or not the hourglass model actually makes sense. So for my end too, I'm going to use the data set from this paper. This is a paper published early this year. So they sequenced 10 species from 10 different phenons. The sequence there, the development of transcript of 10 species from 10 different phenons. And they found actually a really striking result. They found they involved the hourglass model, which says the early and the late phase of annual and the late phase of the embryogenesis is converged, but the hardware middle stage, which is really diverged across all the species defined. And they provide some explanation why the reward the hourglass model happens. That's because at that stage, they just different species, because they sample from different phenomena. So each species will have their species specific regular mechanism. So that's the reason to have reward the hourglass model. But if you look at look at the organism inside of the same phenom, this actually should follow the hourglass model, but across the phenom, how they reward the hourglass model. This is the species sequence there. And on the left is the phylogeny for the 10 different species. So they include the sea lions, the Drosophila, and zebrafish, and the sea urchin, and other species are in the domino. And in the middle here is describes the embryogenesis process.
And so the chordate is a fish, I see. The seventh row is our vertebrate.
Yeah.
Looks like a zebra fish.
Yeah, he's a zebra fish.
Yes.
So this describes the embryogenesis process, and the little part here corresponding to the time point where they sampled the collected the embryo. And here, this remains corresponding to the time for this axis. And the dashed name here corresponds to the phenotypic stage. So I already have the data, and my first thing I wanted to do is this is just a cartoon that describes what I'm going to do. So when I have the data and the all the embryo for different species, this we can use the Sierigans for software and zebrafish as an example here. So because different species have different developmental timing and the habitable timing, so we can apply generalized proposed analysis to amend the and then the 10 series of the transcriptome. And then we can use the LM, the 10 series, to look at each individual gene. So if we plot the gene expression, plot the expression of each individual gene on the mean rate there, we can see some genes are, they have some kind of convergence. And some genes, then the corresponding genes specific, so they will be diverged. And for other genes, they may have some have a stage where all the species are resuming. So this may, this gene may corresponding to the hourglass model. But the data, they collected, they are actually it's a bulk measurement, so to measure the expression for the whole transcript, for the whole embryo. So but recently there is a new technology called the single cell RNA seq. So this method is able to sequence the transcriptome for each individual cells. So already there are some
in the far right graphs. What's the vertical axis?
So what it is going to be the expression value for a particular gene.
For a specific gene.
Yeah, so different color.
Okay, so the vertical is?
X-axis is the NN, the 10 series. And
that's expression, the vertical.
This is the expression, three different.
And they have this expression for many genes.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, so currently we have a new technology called the single-cell RNA seq. So we are actually able to sequence each individual cell for the envelope. And we also actually have a few data sets. So this is a data set. This is a picture I take from one study. In that study, they sequenced the most embryogenesis, or they sequenced the embryo from zygote to 64 cells. And what this figure shows here, they describe the each dot corresponding to cell type, and the name corresponding to the info the development stages. So, for the most embryogenesis, they involved firstly go from a TE lineage and ACM lineage, and then the ACM lineage, which is the inner cell mass, can be faster become to TE and the EPA. EPA is epiplast. P is a primitive endodome. We actually also have some data for the human and I couldn't find the chicken, but we do have human and mice. So my hobby is this deliverable is a lot here. So if we have the human and the mice and we have chicken, and then we also have the tree structure, it's a square thing. The people, we can actually also use a generalized probability analysis to append all three different species, and then we can do the similar things as before. We can look at each individual genes and see what's a lot. Some genes are changed, some genes are converged, some genes are diverged, and some other genes that have some kind of hourglass model. Another thing is I can also try to relate the transcriptional change to the morphologic change. So we can take the data from the other descent, basically look at the morphologic change, and then to see whether or not the gene has some relationship to the morphologic change. So the whole idea behind all my project is this picture I'm taking from Conrad Wernicke. So we here, Wernicke has a really nice book called The Strategy of Gene, which was published more than 60 years ago. And in this picture, he describes for each different cell, we have some genes or some chemicals, the interaction between genes. So the mouse here corresponding to each individual genes, and the link here corresponding to each different interaction between different genes. And the surface of the top, you can think of the shape of the shape of some species, and because of the interaction between different different genes, so we are negatively different change of the morphology.
So your data sets so far are transcriptome data sets.
I have three, two different, I think three, yeah. So one is the data set from this group.
You told us about these.
Then we have data of this. And then we also have the GIST bubble RNC data.
So the, but the morphology, you don't have actual data, though.
I have morphology for this.
In the human embryo you have measurements of volumes of different parts of the embryo. Yeah.
And there also the relative position of each organ.
I just a small technical point. You want to use if you want to use Procrustes analysis to align gene expression profiles. Procrustes is linear, that is, it's you don't have a rotation step here.
But I have a probably have P, this one. Yeah.
Well,
that's not Procrustes.
But I guess the point I want to make is the Procrustes style things will move things linearly and will stretch them uniformly and rotate them. But it doesn't do anything nonlinear. In these, in the data you showed early on, it looked as if the alignment of events in different species would require you to stretch some parts of the axis much more than others. So I would not confine yourself to Procrustes. To least square, to a linear transformation, but allow some quadratic or higher order terms in there so that you could stretch some parts more than others.
Yeah. And I think there is another method called dynamic time wrapping. You can stretch.
There will be other methods out there, yeah.
But you want to be careful because for the genetic code along a chromosome, alignment isn't a metaphor, it's an actual operation on a geometry. For those graphs up here, alignment is just a metaphor. There isn't any geometry associated with what you just did in those three colored pictures over there, correct? There's nothing geometric going on.
Well, I'm not so sure, because those are the those are the separation of tissues.
But there's no metric on the picture at all. It's just a verbal classification.
What's the vertical axis there?
So this is actually
the horizontal.
So we have the coordinates of each point. So
on the fish I see IPM to EPI is going straight down. On the human ICM to EPI is going at 45 degrees to the right. What has rotated 45 degrees here?
This is a tree diagram of separation of tissues. The horizontal axis is just for your visual, convenience.
But then, as I said, it's just a metaphor.
And
it's
also the left right, the only thing that left right means here is to keep separate which one is the TE and which one is the
PE. It's just a diagram. It doesn't have a metric.
It has some sort of a vertical axis. What is it?
This is so I did probably didn't explain pretty clearly. So what I did for this is when we sequence the genome, right, we sequence each individual cells, we have already even individual cells, we have more than maybe 10,000 genes. So we have gene 1, gene 2, and until gene maybe 10,000. And we sequence a bunch of different cells. We sequence the patterns of cells, assortment of cells. And then what I did is to make that figure, what I did is I needed to do some kind of dimension reduction. I could make just a huge matrix. Maybe just if I think this matrix is 1,000 times 1,000. So once 10,000 is a gene, 1,000 is a cells, and then we can make it only to two dimension reduction. And then I have a really good every next algorithm we can organize the data to the graph stretch. And when I organize the data, I'm going to get some tree strategies. So what we actually have is I have two results. One is the points, so just that just points correspond in each engineer cell, and I also have a tree structure. This is a structure I learned from the data. So what I can do is I can then use this coordinates from this reduced dimension. You can use a PCL or use other method to do the dimension reduction. And then we have the coordinates in each individual cells. And then we can do this for different species. If this is only for the mice, and this is for the human, and then this is for chicken, then we have similar data. We have similar tree structure for different data.
But what's the contents of that M matrix? Is that expression information?
This is the expression values of each gene.
So you can't use PCA because they're all positive variables.
Well, they take logs.
But you can't take the log of zero. You can't do PCA of expression data. That's been known since Terry Speed's book. You can't do PCA. It's wild data.
Whatever method you use for dimension reduction there, these are a lot of genes, and there's a lot of cells, and those cells are at they're in different parts of the embryo, and they're at different stages of development.
Yeah.
And then you're using, if this is similar to Cole Trapnell's approaches, this are using the data, the multivariate data on expression, to place the cells in a space, in this case with some principal componency space, but in such a way that you get a branching diagram showing the cells going off on different developmental paths. It's an empirical way of but they really have these data showing the cells going and changing their gene expression as they become different tissues. And they get a branching tree diagram.
But you're not going to get a diagram that has a vertical trajectory. This is a metaphor.
Well,
this wouldn't be vertical.
The things there are some kind of dimension reduction on the original, original coordinates.
I guess my point is not related to morphometrics at all. I have enough familiarity with the literature of that matrix M, and enough familiarity with Terry Speed in particular, to know that you cannot do eigenanalysis of a matrix like that. It never works, according to Speed in his book, on gene array data.
I have enough familiarity with Terry Speed to know that he says that everything doesn't work.
Well, that's a man to my own heart. But has he been contradicted? Is there are there some set of assumptions according to which these matrices reduce to two dimensions? Well, it started with a million.
There are interesting questions as to how to do the dimension reduction. Let's leave it at that. But the main limitation, I think this project is great, you have lots to do. It seemed to me that the connection to morphometrics was in your proposed use of a Procrustes-like scheme to align things. But there's no, I don't see, since you don't have the volumes of organs data for more than one species yet.
I have human, mice, and chicken.
So you do have human and chicken.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the contact of this with morphometrics.
The loss of the
volumes. Yeah. I think we've run over and you've been very patient about waiting around. I'm sorry, everybody. But these have been very substantive presentations. But each of you can work for about a year and turn in a project. Or maybe
that's
turn
on
something.
The thing. He said it, and due date has changed.
No.